Good morning, everybody. Happy Saturday. My name is Darren Lapomi. I am a professor of nanoengineering and chemical engineering. My training is chemistry, so a lot of natural sciences and engineering, but I also do a lot of work with video production and art even, and social sciences research, so I'm hoping I cover a bunch of ground here. So I'm a professor of nano and chemical engineering at UC San Diego, and as of July, thank you, great to hear the enthusiasm for UCSD. I'm also associate dean for students as of July 1st. Prior to that, I was the faculty director of our IDEA Engineering Students Center, which is our success center and really the hub for inclusion, diversity, excellence, and achievement at UCSD. So I'm going to open up with a little bit of hopefully this isn't too much of a bucket of cold water, but answering the question, why do you want to go to grad school? Because there was this time when Ted Kennedy ran for president in like 1980 or something, and he was in the primary against Jimmy Carter, and someone asked him why he wanted to be president, and he couldn't answer the question. He just hemmed and hawed for like 15 minutes, and the interviewer's like, okay. We're talking in grad school about two different types of degree programs, the MS and the PhD. The MS is highly recommended in most fields, but oftentimes you can get your company to pay for this, which is pretty awesome. And sometimes you can even do the MS while doing it concurrently or doing it concurrently with your job. So just by show of hands, how many people are like pretty sure they want to do a PhD? Okay, pretty sure they want to stop at MS? Okay, cool, a good mix. So my wife, for example, did her MBA well after completing her schooling, once she was in a job. So what is a PhD? A PhD, I think the media thinks that it's synonymous with expert. It definitely isn't. What it is being a Jedi master in creating knowledge. So you're not just becoming an expert in that technique or that area in which you did your thesis, but what you are an expert in is the process of creating knowledge. Don't go to grad school just because you don't know what else to do. You've been a student your whole life, and most of us were students our whole life when we needed to make this decision. Or don't go if you're afraid of the real world. I admit that this had a lot to do with my decision to go to grad school. Grad students don't get paid that much. They do get paid, which is awesome. I didn't realize that until way late, like well into undergrad. I didn't realize that grad students either got paid as a TA or as a grad student researcher until an embarrassingly late point in my life. And they work long hours. You want to have a good sense of work-life balance, but the fact is the reason that people get a salary premium is because grad school is kind of more work than a full-time job. Sometimes your topic can seem all, you know, consuming, especially in PhD studies when you kind of think about how you're going to what resource you're going to look up or how you're going to do that experiment. And if you go the PhD route, you'll be spending much of your 20s in grad school. And at the end, I'm really giving a good pitch, aren't I? At the end, you're overqualified for many jobs, especially as a PhD, and sometimes you can feel that you've educated yourself out of the workforce. But the silver lining, and it is significant, is that the job you get will probably be better and more fulfilling. If you want to go on into academia, a graduate degree will be a necessity. And I would say that go to grad school if you love learning and research for a PhD or a research-oriented MS degree, and you really want the salary premium as well. Okay, so with those disclaimers out of the way, just a little bit of my biography, how I somehow feel qualified to talk to a much bigger crowd than I was expecting. So I was chair of our graduate admissions committee between 16 and 18. I was director of our Idea Engineering Student Center between 21 and 22, and I've been associate dean for students for about the last 4 months. I've reviewed graduate applications in multiple programs, so nanoengineering, chemical engineering, material science, chemistry, and biochemistry. I personally receive about 75 applications per year, so that is a number of applicants from all over the world that put my name as their preferred advisor, and I have to see all of those, and I welcome the opportunity to see all of those. And also I review additional applications for research fellowships in the natural sciences, social sciences, and arts and humanities. As I wrote this slide on Wednesday, I was on a virtual panel for National Institutes of Health review. So I was reviewing colleagues' grant applications that had a bio sketch, which is the professor's version of a statement of purpose. So I was reviewing a lot of those while I was doing this. You'll be applying for things all your life. I'm still applying for things. I had to get this associate dean job and submit my CV and what I thought I could do with this position. A statement of purpose has different words, different names as you go on in your career. You might call it a cover letter at some point. It's kind of like a statement of purpose. And it's a place where you want to talk about your research interests and and how your past experiences shaped the person that is now applying for this position. So, how a graduate admissions committee works. In grad admissions, I'm going to speak about UCSD, and I suspect most R1 institutions, but things will be different in other places, but I can only tell you about what I know most intimately. And in our committee, it's made up of 3 to 6 professors and a graduate administrator. The committee sees all the applications. Some schools, not UCSD, but some schools triage, that is, they put to the side applications based on GPA. For example, 3.0, 2.7, 2.5, something like that. That's more common for MS programs than for PhD. I would say that in general, the criteria for PhD is more welcoming of a non-traditional type of application, MS, because there is just such a huge number of MS applications, they tend to use more concrete criteria for better or worse. Some PhD programs prioritize based on undergraduate research experience, so things like publications, conference presentations, things like that, undergraduate poster presentations, and so forth. Applications in many places, so many schools, are distributed to faculty by the indicated faculty interest. So a lot of schools will ask you, what faculty are you most interested in working with as having as your advisor or your lab if it's a STEM field? And the diversity of the entering class is usually considered to a varying extent. At UCSD, we put a very high premium on diversity. We try to take a holistic approach to the evaluation. So a lot of times the student with a 2.8 GPA might have a lot of service experience. They might have done something that's, you know, truly amazing or conquered barriers in their lives, and that certainly goes into our evaluation. But keep in mind that space is very limited. So I said that, for example, I have about 75 students per year put my name down. I might have space for 1 or 2 PhD students in my group. Master's students, there's a lot more space because most master's students applying to my program are applying for coursework or a comprehensive exam style master's as opposed to a thesis style master's. It is important not to take rejection personally. for a number of reasons. One is that if you don't apply, you'll never get in. And if you don't get rejected, you're not taking enough risks. There was a period in my professional career where I applied to 11 NSF grant applications over 8 years in a row, and all 11 were rejected in a row. I don't have that slide here, but I have actually put it on, I have a talk on this on rejection on YouTube, and I just put them down. It's like, first one I ever submitted, awarded, and then declined 11 times. And that happens, but the ones that I eventually did get wouldn't have happened if I didn't apply. Maybe the person reading your application didn't have lunch yet. And I hate to say that hanger is a thing, but you don't know what's going on in the people's minds, and that's why it's important to have a broad-based application portfolio, apply to a lot of places. What is the role of the statement of purpose in the application package? So the statement of purpose, it has a, we call it the statement of purpose because it's different from a personal statement, as in an undergraduate application. In an undergraduate application, you can talk about being in an officer in the marching band, or Model UN, or a club that you were in, or why you liked a certain course, or what a certain professor meant to you. But in a statement of purpose, in applying to grad school, you are talking specifically about your goals in pursuing this quite specific kind of graduate study. So what are your goals? Why do you love research, especially for PhD or thesis-oriented master's programs? How does your past research tie into what you want to do? Are you changing research areas from undergraduate? And I would encourage you to change your research area from undergraduate. If you were able to do some research and you got into a lab, or you did an REU somewhere, or you did some a paper, like a senior thesis you're doing a senior thesis with an advisor, maybe take this opportunity to choose another topic. Sometimes the research that you are doing as an undergraduate, or that you did as an undergraduate, is just by luck. That professor happened to respond to your email. That graduate student who happened to TA your course happened to have a spot available on their project. And just because that one moment in your life is lucky does not mean that you have to do that thing the rest of your career. People like to, there's a psychological barrier to moving on and doing something new. There's a lot of inertia. The reason is because people like doing what they're good at doing. The reason why I never became a concert pianist, well, there are many, many reasons. I'm not that good, first of all. But the reason is because I only play the things that I sound good playing. I don't learn anything new, and I never get any better. So that is a barrier that a lot of us carry around with us. And it's perfectly okay to change research areas. Why? Why are you changing research areas? Mention faculty preferences by name in your SOP. Some departments actually require you to reach out to faculty ahead of time, or your application basically has no chance. In 2017, I had a student who was at the top of their class in chemical engineering. In 2017, UC San Diego graduated more chemical engineers than any other campus in the US. It's about 270 in that class year. And he was number one. And he applied to a number of graduate programs, including two of the places that I went to for my PhD and postdoc, and got rejected from both of them, even though I wrote in the letter that this was the best candidate that I had ever recommended for for graduate school. And it didn't matter because no one was there on the other end to look for his application. Not every school is like that. Only some schools are like that. But if you are applying to a school where the input of the advisor that you want to work with is required, you need to find that out. So email the program coordinator and make sure you get that information. Sometimes it's on the website. Oftentimes it is. Take your SOP and have several nice friends review it. What do I mean by nice? A nice friend is someone who might maybe had a friend like this in undergrad, who's still my best friend to this day, who is smarter than me, but I'm not afraid of being of feeling like I'm an idiot in front of him. I don't feel like what I'm gonna say, he's not gonna judge me or I'm not gonna feel embarrassed by showing something that's not perfect. Once you believe it is perfect, send it to your advisor. That could be an advisor on a senior thesis project or in a lab, or just a professor that you have a good relationship with at your current school. Send it to another mentor, if you have time. I know it's crunch time. I know it's crunch time like right now, right? So if you have another mentor, another friend who can read it dispassionately, that would be great. Sadly, many personal statements, statement of purposes, will not be read all the way through, but there are things you can do to make it enticing so that they don't all start out. Like say I'm in an engineering school, 40% of applications start with, "I played with Legos as a kid," and that's how I got into engineering. Basic components of a statement of purpose: having a title is a plus. If for aesthetics, if for nothing else. I find that often if you have a nice thread running through your statement of purpose, a title can be really, really helpful. It also breaks up the application visually, like to have a nice bold title at the top and then the text. Take all the space allowed. It shows enthusiasm. So we have a limit of, I think, 2 or 3 pages in our program currently. And if someone takes up 3/4 of a page, it doesn't look like they put in that much effort into it. So because I hate to admit that grad committees are sometimes overwhelmed, we get 600 applicants per year between PhD and MS. Some SOPs will not be read all the way through, so make sure you structure it in a cascaded manner. What do I mean by cascaded manner? I'll go through that in a moment. Basically, what it means is put the important takeaways up close to the top and then develop and develop and develop. Don't just summarize your resume or CV because the admissions committee already has your resume or CV, and it's usually a lot easier to get through a resume CV than it is a statement of purpose. Don't make the reader wait until the end of the statement of purpose to see what you want to do. Say that early on. So what we need an executive summary paragraph. This is like business speak for an abstract. A brief biography. Describe your research as a whole in the frame of what you want to do at the university you are applying to. So what does that mean? Describe your research as a whole. It doesn't mean that as maybe in high school, you were lucky enough to maybe do a week visitation somewhere in a lab, or maybe as a undergrad, you got to do an REU, or maybe you did a senior thesis. Maybe you have like these three things or two things, or one thing where you did a couple different, you worked in a couple different topics. Describing everything chronologically without a thread running through it is kind of a mistake because people can see that on the resume or your CV. People can already see the chronological description of what you did. So this is not just a historical accounting of your REUs, projects, or other research experience. And then finally, conclude with the logic about why the program fits with your vision and what you bring to the institution. Some programs put a high premium on demonstrated commitment to outreach and diversity or the broader impacts of your work. I would say to plug UCSD, we definitely do that. But more generally, but they do this less so than for the NSF-GRFP. How many are planning on applying to the NSF-GRFP? Okay, a good number. All right, timeline and strategy. Start putting down your ideas as soon as possible. So I usually find like life hack techniques kind of obvious usually, but I'll give you a few that sometimes work for me. I make notes on my phone, like I use voice to text a lot, like walking down the street, I'm like, oh, that would be a good line to put in my statement of purpose. And I'll just go to notes, microphone, and I'll just say it. And I'll have a document. And sometimes I'll get so many of these kind of key phrases that I kind of like, and I'll build a whole document around it. You can email yourself key phrases that you want to include, and as soon as you open up your inbox, you have it there in the subject, and you can just paste it into your document. Build your statement of purpose around a central theme or at least a few key ideas. Again, this is so important, I put it here again. Don't just summarize your CV in chronological order, like first I did this, then I did that. Give the why you did these things, what was exciting about them, and how these experiences influenced why you want to work on the particular topic that you're applying to grad school to work on or to study. Get some examples from grad student mentors. So there might be grad students at your institutions. You might have a friend of a friend of a friend who's a grad student. Email me. We can share with you examples, anonymized, or things that your mentors may have written when they were in your position. Talk to your advisors as soon as possible. I have no idea what I meant by that second last bullet. When receiving criticism, don't take it personally. Okay, what are some pitfalls and things that we might have a mistaken impression about, or things that we know we need to manage by way of the statement of purpose? One of them is GPA. Having a GPA definitely does not make you the smartest person in the applicant pool. It might imply that you're smart, but importantly, it indicates that you know how to manage your time. So I'm not saying that time management is important for graduate studies. It has a tendency to drift, especially if your advisor is not around a lot or if there's a big group of people that they're advising. But a GPA, having a GPA that is maybe lower than you might think is where you want it to be when you apply. It doesn't mean that you don't know how to manage your time, but having a high GPA suggests that you were able to cram in what you needed to do as an undergraduate. And because high GPAs don't happen by accident, I'm going to tell you the GRE is not required, especially after COVID, by very many places these days. I bombed the GRE math. I bombed it. I got less than 50th percentile. When I got that score, I freaked out. I thought my chances of getting into grad school were completely sunk. I feel that I have I definitely have like generalized anxiety disorder, and I'm not a good test taker. And my brain, like most of the bandwidth of my brain, was just consumed with fear and anxiety while I was at the test, and I only had like 10% of my brain left to do it. That's my excuse, but I think there's a lot of there's probably a lot of truth to it. But getting a high GPA, it doesn't really happen by accident. So low score is fine, but it's kind of asymmetric, right? A high score, high GPA, it's hard to like just go in there and guess and get a high score, right? So that's the only thing I wanted to say. If the GPA, if your GPA is not where you want it to be by the time you submit your application, that's okay. Just make sure that you that your other qualities that will compensate come through in the SOP. Reviewers are most interested in the improvement, and for people who took calc, that's the derivative. They're interested in a positive dy dx. They want to see that although you were a first year undergraduate and you got all C's because you partied a lot and didn't know how to study and were away from home, maybe you're with a lot of other people who wanted to party a lot, that people understand that, that's fine. But if that went up to B pluses, A minuses by the time, A's by the time you submitted your application, that's as good to me as someone who used to chair a graduate admissions committee as someone who had those scores the entire time. If there was a particular reason why your GPA suffered at a particular point, you can, but are definitely not required to give details because it's none of the reviewer's business. Many applications get triaged by the system or get effectively triaged by the faculty advisors. This is going to happen sometimes. Not everyone is as open-minded and progressive as we would like them to be, but that's the importance of applying to multiple places. This is not about the statement of purpose, but these are other aspects of the graduate application that while I had your attention, I wanted to make sure that we touched on. Letters of recommendation. You want three letters from people who know you well, not just the most senior person at your school. Find people who will go to bat for you and take up a lot of the allotted space, right? So an application where there's detail. It's not fluff, it's detail because they actually know the detail. Start building relationships with professors early, especially some of you who may be earlier on, maybe not applying in this cycle, maybe applying next cycle. Go to office hours. Some schools have a dine with the prof or coffee with the prof program. If you don't know the professor, oh yeah, if your school doesn't have a dine with the prof program and you ask them to go out for coffee and they don't pay, then don't ask that person, don't ask that professor for it. If you don't know the professor that well, I mean, a lot of schools ask for three letters, and how many of us had three professors that we really had a close connection with? Not that many, right? So some people will ask you to write the bulk of the letter for you, for them. And this could be anything from bullet points to the whole letter. Follow their instructions pretty closely, and don't give the same letter to two different people if two people ask you to for help in writing the letter. One time I was recommending a PhD student of mine to a postdoc at a famous lab at MIT, and I used the exact same and I'm like, three letters for a postdoc? That's absurd. Sometimes there aren't even one letter required for a postdoc. And so my student needed help because, you know, we weren't used to supplying recommendation letters for postdocs when like multiple from like three people. So I'm like, okay, I'll help this person write their letter for you for this other. And so I had written basically all three of the candidates' letters. And two of them, I started out with the exact same sentence. And I was, and after I realized it, I was like so, I was like so freaked out again that this person who's also senior to me in like the field and this big time professor at MIT was gonna know and was gonna find out, but of course they didn't. And the next day he got accepted, and that was fine. But I'll never make that mistake again. I feel like I'm pulling back the curtain on this a little bit too much, but yeah. It's funny when you read letters, especially when it's letters for other faculty members for some grant or fellowship or something, and you know that letter was written by somebody else or by the candidate themselves. And you see that signature of the person who signed off on it. Even though you know in the back of your mind, you still read it with the voice of the person who purportedly read it. So there's some weird psychological disconnect going on. But anyway, okay, enough of that. When you apply, make sure to go through the form, and for all of your recommenders, make sure you add their phone number, their mailing address, and so on. So every fall, I submit about 100 letters of recommendations for students who have been in my classes and in my lab, and there's nothing worse than re-entering my phone number 150 times each fall, so it's just really nice to do that. Consider writing a nice note for your recommenders. So I just want to mention as a plug, I have a lot of talks on various approaches to applying to grad school that are on my YouTube channel, which is just my name, as well as the Idea Center podcast, where we talk to a diverse range of leaders in STEM education. And then I just want to give you a couple words, because I have so many people here that if you have not already thought about applying to UCSD, I just want to tell you just a little bit about us. We have the IDEA Engineering Student Center. If you're not in engineering, that's fine. We have the Student Success Center in physical sciences as well as biological sciences, which covers like 70% of our undergraduate programs, and they do the same things. So we promote equity, community, and success for all students at UCSD. We have engineering graduate and scholarly talk series. I used to run that particular program. We get people from industry and law and government and academia to come in. We get to have pizza and coffee with them. We have our engineering community hours, which is in the morning, which is donuts and coffee. We have a number of community building events, a number of mentorship opportunities. We have our Jacobs School of Engineering. We have our Graduate Student Council, which runs which oversees about 100 different teams. So 100 different project teams, outreach teams, service teams, diversity organizations that are represented by this group. We have dedicated space, we have project space, we have all kinds of cool resources for you as a graduate student. So I would encourage you to connect with us, email me if you're interested. I can tell you all about it. And at that point, thank you very much for your attention. I'd be happy to answer any questions.